Welcome.
I reckon it's time for a spot of the old cock abridged. This is Game of Thrones Abridged. This is a show in which we analyze, we dissect and deconstruct and reconstruct and reconfigurate the Game of Thrones books chapter by chapter. Today, we're going to talk about the fourth Bran chapter in A Clash of Kings, the second book in the series. This is episode 101 of the show, and I'm so glad you're here. So today we're talking about magic versus reason. We're talking about faith versus physics, as El Producto said. Let's get metaphysical is what I'm trying to tell you, because we're going to be talking about reason versus the supernatural battling through this whole book. That's how this book began. If you all recall, the prologue of A Clash of Kings began with Cressen, the maester, the man of science and reason and rationality, trying to assassinate Melisandre, this priestess of fire and prophecy and magic. And she was all like, hey bud, there exists more in heaven and earth than in your philosophy, bro. And she just quaffed that poison that Cressen poured her, and the magic protected her. And then she forced Cressen to drink the poison and he died, proving the primacy and the supremacy of supernatural doings above subnatural. If magic is supernatural, I guess it's just natural, isn't it? What's subnatural? Is that rocks? If nature is life, and then beneath, is it just molecule? Okay, not helpful. But it's all about the magics, and this whole book is about magic and magical awakenings, because you've got Daenerys making her messianic walk through the red waste, following the red comet like the Star of Bethlehem, and reaching this city and talking to these three wise men, Quaithe, Zaro, and Piat Pri. Only one of them is wise, though, when you really think about it, and none of them had frankincense and myrrh. So the biblical parallel only goes so far, but Daenerys is on a magical quest, is my point, and Bran is now beginning his magical quest. He's discovering his warging, skin-changing powers, and going north to the Three-Eyed Raven is what he's shortly going to begin doing. And Arya is beginning her magical journey because Jaqen H'ghar is appearing in her life very soon and teaching her this faceless men magic. And of course, Stannis has Melisandre, the Red Witch, doing all this shadow binding to assassinate his brother. It's probably what happened to that Haitian bloke. It's all magic rising up. It's like they say in A Feast for Crows, with old powers waken, shadows stir, an age for gods and heroes. So magic is rising up, along with the birth of dragons. And as it turns out, when this new magical force arises, the new world, I suppose, the world of men, the world of mortals, the world of mundane reason and science and such, resists. There's a clash, if you will, between the magical and the non-magical worlds, and the maesters represent that. And so that's why, you know, in the prologue of A Clash of Kings, you got Cressen dying at Melisandre's hands. And then later in this book, you have Luwin dying and bleeding into the Weirwoods. And Luwin in this chapter, as we'll get to, is very much an embodiment of skepticism and reason and the world of men against the rising tide of sorcery. So get excited, folks. So welcome to the stream. Thanks for the super chat from Derek Hanscom, and let's get into it. So here's how the chapter begins. Mira moved in a wary circle, her net dangling loose in her left hand, the slender three-pronged frog spear poised in her right. And the direwolf Summer is watching Mira, and they're circling each other, and then, like, Mira jabs at Summer with her spear, and then the wolf leaps at her. And so, like, this is like a really crazy cold open, right? Because we don't know what's going on here right away. We're like, hang on, Amira and Summer fighting? Is this a battle to the death? Is this the great combat between the Kranig woman and the direwolf? Is this frog versus dog? Frog dog bowl? What's going on here? But then we quickly realize that, like, Summer jumps on top of Mira, and then everyone's, like, laughing and hooting, and Bran is, whoa, and then Mira laughs and rolls around with the wolf, so we realize, oh, no one's killing each other, people are actually having fun. It's just Bran and Jojen and Mira have all become friends at Winterfell, and they're just, like, hanging out and being buds, and it's, like, honestly one of the most heartwarming couple of pages in the book. If not the series. People are actually having a good time. People are actually carefree, and it's really heartwarming and great. But of course, that is, since it's a Song of Ice and Fire, that doesn't last very long. It's going to get dark soon, believe me. Although the chapter's still pretty positive overall, I'd say. Much more positive than most. I think it's interesting how the text emphasizes Summer watching with his golden eyes. Because, of course, you know the name Summer, as in, you know, the season, summer, warmth, light, dawn, which is all good against the darkness of the White Walkers that Bran is positioned to fight against. And the golden eyes themselves look like a sun. I mean, what does a golden eye look like if not a sun? Like dawn. And of course, you know, Bran's first chapter, which is the first chapter in the series, apart from the prologue, like the first line is something about, you know, the dawn dawns dawnily, or whatever it says. The morning had dawned clear and cold with a crispness that hinted at the end of summer. And I like to believe that the final line of A Song of Ice and Fire will be a Bran chapter, and it'll be like, you know, the morning dawned bright and warm with the crispy tastiness that hinted at the beginning of summer. My point being that, like, it would be cool if it was like a palindrome, if it was mirrored, the beginning of the series and the end of the series with Bran's point of view reflecting on the changing of the seasons. I think would give it a really nice, you know, sort of macro, seasonal, cyclic, natural vibe. Going from this, you know, descent into conflict and darkness at the start of the series, this descent into winter, and then, you know, a rise into summer and warmth and prosperity at the end of the series, I think would be great. And I think that's, you know, that's probably what George is going for. George has said many times that he wants a bittersweet ending. Which means there's got to be a bittersweet in there. We've seen a lot of bitter. God knows we've tasted a lot of bitter in this series, so I think the sweetness of summer at the end would be great. I also enjoy Mira's choice of weaponry. She's got the frog spear, which is like a little trident. It's a three-pronged spear. I do have questions about frog spears. Like, is a frog spear designed to spear frogs? Or is it a weapon designed to be utilized by frogs, against frogs? It could be both. Like, was the frog spear developed by frog warriors in the deep, deep amphibious hive worlds of the frog people down in the Hollow Earth, and they forge out of the frog stone and they whittle their slippery weapons to spoink each other in the darkness to rise to supremacy amongst their amphibious foes to gain control over the frog kingdoms? What was the frog spear about? Is that what Poseidon's got? Poseidon's got a trident. It rhymes, actually. Poseidon with the trident. I'm sure someone's used that. Is Poseidon's trident a frog spear? Is Poseidon a frog? I mean, there's all sorts of, like, interspecies mishigos going on with the Olympian gods. I mean, didn't Zeus root a bull, and that's why we have Europe? Like, I'm pretty sure that's what happened. Like, the continent of Europe is named after Europa, and Europa was... I think what happened was that Zeus was, like, really horny for someone called Europa, and then, like, Zeus's wife, Hera, is it Hera? Wanted to not have her husband root Europa. So she changed Europa into a bull, thinking that, well, even my skeevy-ass husband wouldn't root a bull. And then Zeus was like, ha-ha, you underestimate me. And then he had sex with a cow. I think that's what happened. And the cow's name, the woman who got turned into a cow, was Europa. And that's why Europe is called Europe. Can you imagine living in a continent named after a cow that a lightning god had sex with? I can't imagine it. I mean, what are the other continents? What is Asia named after? Remember when there used to be Asia Minor and Asia Major? Asia Major is also a gift to rappers everywhere. That's like Poseidon with his trident in Asia Major. I mean, whew, you could sing it in a major key. All right, we're not going to do any tangents, so don't even worry about that. But I've just got to look. We'll have to have a separate episode about the frog spear because I've got so many frog spear questions. I mean, could you spear three frogs at once? Is that the idea with the three prongs? You could have a frog on each prong. It's a frog prong on your frog spear. Or could you flip it around? You get a fourth frog on the handle. It's really a quad frog spear. Okay, we're moving on. Uncommon Beat in the live stream chat says that a frog spear is a four-pronged spear, commonly used for small game such as frogs. Well, why's Mira got a three-pronged frog spear? Did one of the prongs break off? I guess that's the benefit of having multiple prongs, is that if a prong breaks off, you got a spare prong. You don't want to run out of prongs. I'm sure it's happened to everyone, but if you get backed into a corner and you run out of prongs, you're going to be glad you got a spare prong on your frog spear. Because, oh boy, not going to prong your way out of this one if you've only got one prong. All right. Harun in the live chat says that Africa is named after King Musa's third husband. I think Harun might have made that up, but I'm gonna Google that later. I'm loving continent names. Someone needs to... All right, moving on. But the net is also cool. You don't often see people using nets in combat, but I can see the utility. Like, if you just, like, scramble up your enemy, if they're all wrapped up which way, like a fish getting caught by a super trawler, no one's getting out of that. Like, Summer can't get out of the net. I mean, Summer doesn't have opposable thumbs, but if I was trapped in a net, I wouldn't know what to do. I'm interested in, like, the concept of, like, non-lethal weapons. Because, like, you know, not to get real, but there's some discussion about, like, you know, certain times and situations when you gotta put someone down, but you don't want to murder someone. You know, I'm in the camp of, like, you know, killing being usually a bad thing to do. So how do you, like, if someone's running amok, if someone's a danger to themselves and others, how do you pacify them? How do you put them down without hurting them? And, like, you know, we got guns, but they kill people. So why don't we have more, like, non-lethal weapons? I'm not suggesting a net would work. But what about, like, in that movie The Incredibles? Remember in The Incredibles, there was that great scene where Mr. Incredible, he's got super strength. How are you going to stop a man with super strength? Well, here's what you do. The bad guy or whoever had these, like, these little pellets that were shot at Mr. Incredible. And then the pellets stuck, they were, like, super sticky, and they would inflate. So there were, like, dozens and dozens of these inflating orbs of, like, they're like sticky balloons. And he just gets covered in them, pop, 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 and then they all inflate. He's like, and he can't even, like, move or, like, go anywhere or do anything because he's just, like, suffocated. And it doesn't hurt him, it doesn't kill him, but he just can't do anything or move away when he's, like, it's in, there's this novel called The Supernaturalist by Owen Colfer, who wrote Artemis Fowl. And The Supernaturalist was, like, this really banging, like, one-off young adult novel that he wrote that was really cool. And in The Supernaturalist, they had these non-lethal weapons that were used by, like, law enforcement and stuff, where instead of shooting, you know, bullets or whatever, they would shoot these, like, gel things, these, like, gel sack things. They're, like, these large, like, imagine, like, a beanbag of jelly. And like, the jelly would just, like, swallow up a person, and then they would just be, like, helplessly stuck into this like sticky lump of goo that would just hold them, which I'm sure is someone's fetish. But they just get like stuck in this like goo and they can't do anything or move around because they're stuck inside this gelatinous blob until they're rescued. And I think the book mentioned that like, oh, and sometimes people like suffocate inside of them and stuff. It was a very dystopian book. I mean, the book also had, the book had these paralegals who would parachute into battle. Really confused me about the definition of the term paralegal for a while, but paralegals in The Supernaturalist, if I remember correctly, would literally parachute into battle and they would fire all these gel rounds and pacify everyone so that they could then, you know, begin the legal proceedings with all of the relevant evidence having captured everybody. So, you know, I like the net. And I like the frog spear. I just love Mira's shtoil. I feel like she's got some great energy, good moves, keep it up, proud of you. Thank you for the super chat from Huichi Lim, and thank you for the donation from Ufweku, who says, first time catching this live, love your shriftiness. Love your shriftiness too, Ufweku. Moving on. So they're rolling around, they're having a good time, Bran, Mira, Jojen, and Summer, they're just frolicking, they're just kicking their heels up, they're just running through the meadow, they're doing what children should be doing. That's the tragedy. I mean, Bran is like, what, 9 years old? 8 years old. He's 8 years old and then 9 years old in A Clash of Kings. He shouldn't have to be worrying about the apocalypse. He shouldn't have to be worrying about northern and southern politics and his brother Rob marching to war and his mother gone down south with him and his father being murdered. Bran should be frolicking with Doggo in the meadow, and that's what's happening. And for about a page and a half, it's very heartwarming. And you'll notice, of course, that none of this happened in the TV show. Jojen and Mira don't hook up with Bran until much later on. Which I think indicates that, you know, D&D, the creators of the TV show, kind of lost interest in Bran pretty early. Like, there aren't very many Bran scenes in Season 2 and Season 3. And Bran isn't even in Season 5 at all, which, you know, as many people have noted, makes it a little bit ironic when Tyrion at the end is like, oh, who's got a better story than old Branno Starko over here, mate? Let's make him king. And it's like, he has the best story? He wasn't in half the story. Anyway. So everyone's having a good time. And then Mira's like, man, it's so crazy that, like, we can just, like, roll around with this wolf and he's not, like, he's not angry or anything. And Bran's like, no, Summer won't hurt anyone because he knows that I like you, so he won't hurt you. Because, like, the wolves have hurt some people. Like, Shaggy Dog, I think it's maybe a couple chapters in the future, Shaggy Dog attacks Lewin at one point, which, come to think of it, also fits into the theme of, like, the magic versus reason and skepticism theme. And Tyrion gets attacked by the direwolves, in the first book. He doesn't get seriously hurt, but he does get roughed up a bit, which also wasn't in the show. Not including the direwolves was such a disservice in the TV show, because they are so important to the whole, like, Stark identity and the whole magical thing. I mean, that's the problem with the Game of Thrones thing, is that, like, Bran being king is like the ultimate triumph of the theme of magic. Like, we're talking about how in A Clash of Kings is about the triumph of magic over the non-magical world, and the Game of Thrones TV show downplayed the magical elements at almost every opportunity, which would be fine if they, you know, changed the focus of the story to be less magical, like, consistently. But then they pulled Bran Stark Greenseer King out of their asses in the end, which doesn't fit when the rest of the story downplayed the magic. You've got to upplay the magic if you're going to make Bran King, I think, because otherwise it just doesn't mean anything, or it just seems to come out of nowhere. Anyway, so Jojo and Mira have become good friends with Bran. They've stayed around after the Harvest Feast. And Bran really likes Mira because Mira reminds Bran of Arya. She's like a tomboy. She can run and throw and play and get dirty and do cool stuff. She's 15 years old. And And I wonder if that might indicate that, like, the Kranigmen, because the Reeds come from a very different culture to most of the people in Westeros. The Kranigmen live in the Neck, this mysterious, marshy, swampy place. The Kranigmen are physically different to most Westerosi, because they're very, like, thin and short, and their eyes are sometimes funny colors, and you know, the implication is that they interbred with the Children of the Forest a long time ago. There's a lot of, like, weird magical bestiality going on in this series. Lots of hybrid creatures. I, for one, suspect that the Starks might have interbred with the White Walkers back in the distant past, and I think that's sort of what the Night's King story indicates. And, you know, the Grey King of the Ironborn is said to have taken a mermaid to wife. And the Squishers are said to have sex with human women. Osha says that Hodor has giant's blood in him. Old Nan says that the wildlings sleep with the White Walkers to sire terrible half-human children. In Norvos, slave women mate with wolves in torch-lit cellars. In Gorgossos, the Valyrians bred slave women with beasts to bring forth half-human children. The ghost of Highheart looks like she could be half-child of the forest, half-human. There are so many examples of... And the Targaryens. The Targaryens say that they are the blood of the dragon. They believe that they are descended from dragons. There is so many... There's so much talk about, like, half-human, half-non-human organisms, that I think it's very reasonable to suspect that the Kranigmen are part Children of the Forest. And that also explains Jojen having the green sight, which is the power of the old gods to see the future and to skin change and to see through trees and stuff like that. Because the Children of the Forest had that power, and the Kranigmen seem to have that power, or at least Jojen Reed does. And Jojen is weird. Jojen is so solemn and serious that Old Nan calls him Little Grandfather. And we learn later that, you know, Jojen, as a greenseer, as someone who can see the future in dreams, in his green dreams, when he's token up on those 420 Blazit green dreams, he has seen the day that he dies. Jojen knows how he'll die. He's seen the future. And that informs everything that he does. I think that's why he's so solemn and sad. It's because he knows he's going to die soon. And spoiler, he's probably going to be mashed into a paste by Bloodraven. And there's this really, like striking moment where, like, you know, Mira says that, oh, you know, he has dreams of the future, and sometimes they come true. And then Jojen says, there is no sometimes. And then a look passed between Jojen and Mira. And Mira looked defiant, and Jojen looked sad. So the implication there is that Mira wants to believe that Jojen won't have to die the way that he's seen in his dreams. Mira wants to believe that her brother will survive, but Jojen believes that the dreams are always true, and he believes that he will die. Which raises that broader question of, like, you know, can dreams and prophecies and visions of the future be averted? I mean, I think it's Cersei who thinks that, well, what's the point of seeing the future if I can't avert the future? What's the point of prophecies if I can't change what's going to happen? Like, what's the point? And most of the time, dreams and prophecies in this series come true, even when you try to avert them. Like, Cersei, I think, is definitely going to fail to avert the whole Valonqar thing. I mean, George Martin has talked about this. He likes prophecies to come true, but in an unexpected way. And all the prophecies actually achieve is sometimes to cause themselves to become true, self-fulfilling prophecy, by the fear and the neurosis of the people who have heard the prophecy. But sometimes prophecies can be averted. For example, the prophecy of the stallion who mounts the world. The Dothraki prophesy that Daenerys' child Rhaego will be the stallion who mounts the world and will grind cities into dust. And then Miri Mazdur was like, you know what? I feel like I don't want cities to be ground into dust. I think that maybe a Dothraki barbarian king who destroys the world, maybe not a good thing. So Miri Mazdur, being like the hero of her own story, decides to stop this prophesied monster being born and uses the magic that she used to keep Drogo alive. She sucked away the life force of Rhaego, and Rhaego died as a dragon monster filled with grave worms. Rhaego died. And so the prophecy of the stallion that mounts the world was averted. I mean Daenerys had that vision in the House of the Undying of Rhaegar, of this powerful half Dothraki, half Targaryen warlord burning the world around him. And that is a vision of the future that does not come true because Rhaegar died. So visions can be averted. Prophecies can be averted. So maybe it is possible for Jojen to escape his predicted death. But maybe the fact that he believes that it's inescapable makes it inescapable. That's the thing. Prophecies are fucking maddening. You can never know for sure. You can never know for sure. And you know, there are also false visions. Like you know, part of this whole green seer Mishigos is that, you know, you can not only see the future, you can also enter the minds of other creatures. You can skin change into animals, like wolves, like Summer, and you can appear in the dreams of others. Because Jojen says that I've seen the Three-Eyed Crow. The Three-Eyed Crow has appeared in my dreams and guided me to come here to meet you. So you know, you can use the dreams to appear in people's visions. I mean, Quaithe appears in Daenerys' visions. In that case, using a glass candle, presumably, as like the tool to appear in each other's visions. And that can be used for good, but that can also be used to manipulate people and to mislead people. And that's what happens to Bran, because, like, you know, Bran doesn't realize that Bloodraven is a creepy corpse man surrounded by skulls in a cave full of creepy children pixies. Bran thinks that the Three-Eyed Crow is a nice old wizard who'll fix his legs. Bran never agreed. Bran never wanted to become a weird greenseer wizard. But he's tricked and manipulated into it by Bloodraven through Jojen. And you got to wonder what Jojen knows. Like, does Jojen know that Bloodraven is a fucking 100-year-old Targaryen bastard cold-ass motherfucker in a cave full of skulls? Or is Jojen as ignorant as Bran is? And how much is Bloodraven choosing to let these people know? It's all super manipulative and evil, and it ties into the whole Lovecraftian thing of like people driven mad by strange dark gods for their own unknowable purposes. It ain't good. Thanks for the super chat from Chinedu, who says, "Does Miri Mazdur kill Drogo on purpose?" So you're asking about like the treatment. So yeah, so Drogo gets wounded in the first book, and Daenerys says, "Miri Mazdur, please heal him. Put this poultice on the wound." And Miri Mazdur says, "All right, there you go." And the wound festers, and Drogo almost dies. Practically, he does die. But then Miri Mazdur uses the magic to like keep him alive as like a vegetable. But then Daenerys kills him anyway. So maybe Miri Mazdur pretended to heal Drogo, but actually decided to kill Drogo because she didn't want him destroying any more villages, because her own village of the Lazarene was killed by Drogo. And I don't know. I don't know if there's any conclusive evidence either way whether Miri Mazdur deliberately killed Drogo or not. I tend to think that she didn't. Like, I haven't seen. I don't think that Miri Mazdur poisoned Drogo or anything. But I think that once he failed, then I don't know. I'd have to sort of reread those chapters, because you know, I think Miri Mazdur, you know, did use her magic to make Daenerys' unborn child die. So she was willing to work against them, and killing Drogo would make sense in terms of those motivations. But yeah, I don't know. I'd have to sort of reread those chapters, I think. Thanks for the super chat from Diego, who says, "Hi, Swift, can't stay. Any chance you read Ted Chiang's short stories?" Yeah, I have read some of them. So the movie Arrival, some of y'all might have seen that sci-fi movie where there's like some squids in a big black spaceship and the lady's got to talk to them. That was based on a story by Ted Chiang. He's also got this weird story where like some super high IQ geniuses have like a genius battle, and they use that they're so smart that they can like control their hormones and pheromones inside their body to attack each other on like a biological cellular level or something. That one was weird. He had another one though. He had another one called The Tower of Babel, I think it was called. And it's about this tower. It's set in like this medievalish world, where they're using all their resources to build a tower to the sky, and the sky is like a solid object. And then like I won't spoil what happens. I did like that story a lot. So yeah, I have read a little bit of Ted Chiang, and I do recommend his story, The Tower of Babel or whatever it's called. I think it's very cool. It tickles a lot of my funny bones. Thanks for the super chat from Murph as well. Alrighty. So, yeah, Jojen, Mira, what a time. And they talk about Howland Reed. Bran says, like, oh, who taught you how to fight with... Who taught you how to fight with a frog spear and a net? Was it a frog? And Mira says, nah, I wasn't taught by my master at arms because we don't have a master at arms at my home, Greywater Watch, in the neck. We have no knights, we have no master at arms, and we have no maester, which is like, whoa. I mean, the Krenigmen, or at least the Reeds, have no maesters, master at arms, or knights. That makes them so culturally divorced and so separated from the rest of Westeros. Like, are there any other families in noble ruling families in Westeros who don't have a maester or a knight? That's crazy. Like, even the hoary old Northmen up in the far north have maesters. And so they really are like a people apart. And she talks about how, you know, the castle of Greywater Watch is a moving castle. So ravens can't even find it. It's a moving castle. And you know, the fact that there is a moving castle ruled by Howland Reed evokes the movie Howl's Moving Castle, which is one of those great anime movies. But is it Studio Ghibli? Or Miyazaki? What's his name? And so some people wonder if George Martin was inspired by that movie. The movie came out after this book, A Clash of Kings. The Howl's Moving Castle movie was in 2004. Clash of Kings came out in 1998. We are reading a more than 23-year-old book, just by the way. This book is half a century old. Gives you a sense of how dusty it's getting. But the movie Howl's Moving Castle was based on a book by Diana Wynne Jones that came out in 1986. Which is before A Clash of Kings. So it is possible that the moving castle of Howland Reed is a reference to the book Howl's Moving Castle by Diana Wynne Jones. That's quite possible. And, you know, George Martin has had all manner of silly references in A Song of Ice and Fire. Like, there's literally some Tullys in the World of Ice and Fire called, like, Kermit and Elmo and Grover. And there's some sellswords called like Mo and Curly and the other guy, and there's like House Vance is named after a fantasy author of the Tor, which is a fantasy publisher. So many references to fantasy in A Song of Ice and Fire. So I think Howl's Moving Castle is another one of them. So, you know, Howland taught Mira how to fight with a net and stuff. And it makes Howl's Moving Castle, like how the Greywater Watch sounds very mysterious to me. Like they can't be contacted by Raven. There's no maesters there. The castle moves around so no one can find it. It sounds like the perfect place to do some secret magic shenanigans, right? Like, if there was going to be some place with, you know, some green men pulling some green sight stuff, you know, secret sacrifices to the old gods, you know, fraternizing with the Children of the Forest. Maybe there are some Children of the Forest, like, hanging out in the neck, and the Reeds and stuff are hanging out with them. That sounds plausible to me. What if there's some water magic happening in the marshes? What if there are some squishes and things? There could be anything going on in Greywater Watch, and I wonder why, like, what Howland Reed is doing there. I mean, there's all sorts of interesting theories about, like, Mage Mormont and Galbert Glover were sent to Greywater Watch and Howland Reed. Maybe they're hanging out there. Maybe bloody Hal Mullen is there with Ned's bones. Maybe they're all conspiring with the Great Northern Conspiracy with Howland at Greywater Watch, because Howland Reed knows that Jon Snow is the son of Rhaegar Targaryen and Lyanna Stark and is therefore potentially the heir to the throne. Like, all sorts of stuff could be going on in Greywater Watch, and I'm very curious to know what it is. You know, what's he building in there? Go and listen to that Tom Waits song. What's he building in there? That's how I feel about Greywater Watch. And Bran's like, are you serious? You don't have a maester? Your castle moves? Like, what's all that all about, mate? Bran couldn't tell whether Mira was teasing him or not, which is a sort of a paranoia that many characters in A Song of Ice and Fire have. Like, Tywin famously hates being laughed at and is paranoid about people mocking him or shaming him. Tyrion has inherited that fear. Cersei hates being mocked. Theon doesn't like being mocked. Stannis doesn't like being laughed at, like Renly with the peach. Many of the main characters in A Song of Ice and Fire are really paranoid about being made fun of. And I wonder if that relates to George R. R. Martin's psychology and his upbringing. I think Bran very much ties into George Martin's thing. Because, like, in interviews, George Martin has talked about how, you know, he grew up in, Bayonne, New Jersey, and he just lived on this tiny little block. And he just went from his house to his school, and, you know, his family didn't have a car, and they didn't have any money, and they just sort of... He had a very small life and a very small world, and, you know, he was a dorky kid, and he was bullied, and, you know, he imagined these faraway worlds in fantasy books, and he wanted to see these fantastical realms. And that's very similar to Bran, right? Because Bran, once his legs are shattered... He's confined to Winterfell. He can't move around, and he dreams of all these faraway places. He says, He says it right here. Quote: "He yearned to see far places," and that sounds very similar to how George Martin has described his childhood. And the whole, like, you know, George talking about how, oh, you know, he was like bullied and teased when he was a kid. He said that Joffrey, the horrible tyrannical King Joffrey, was inspired by some horrible school kids who bullied George Martin when he was a kid. And so that makes me wonder if this fear of being teased and this paranoia about being laughed at that's shared by so many characters in A Song of Ice and Fire, I wonder if that's inspired by what George Martin has experienced in his own life. Thanks for the super chat from Matt Walker. So Bran mentions Sir Roderick Cassel and says that Roderick is away from the castle at the moment. Oh, and I will note that Bran has seen far places. In the previous book, when he has his flying dream, Bran sees all across Winterfell, and he sees magically through his dream, and he sees as far east as Ashai, and he sees dragons waking in the dawn, and he looks north and he sees the heart of winter, and he cries out in fear. So you know, ironically, Bran has already seen far distant places and will see more far distant places, because that's the point, right? Like, because he's not able to physically move around, the whole magical green sight thing is more appealing to Bran because he can't, you know, move around and see stuff as well now that his legs are hurt. So Bran is freed by his magic, where he is constrained by his body, and that's why he is like the perfect vessel for Bloodraven. I mean, Jojen talks surely about how, you know, when he was little, he was very sick with greywater fever, and he almost died. And that is when the Three-Eyed Crow came to Jojen, because Jojen's powers were also woken by the Three-Eyed Crow. Which, you know, it seems a little bit evil. Like Bran was at his most vulnerable, and then the Three-Eyed Crow turned up and lured him north for Bloodraven's magical machinations. Jojen was sick, almost died, was at his most vulnerable, and that's when Bloodraven turned up. It's like the bloody, you know, unmarked van with the candy inside being offered to the, you know, the most vulnerable, alone, damaged, vulnerable kid. Like, how many children has Bloodraven done this to? How many sick kids has Bloodraven infiltrated the mind of in order to, you know, scout them for green seer potential? I mean, the common theory is that Euron is one of them, right? Euron, many theorize, was visited by the Three-Eyed Crow, and that's how he became the Crow's Eye, and that's how he became obsessed with magic, and that's how he potentially even got skin-changing powers. So there's lots of possibilities there. But the more you think about Bloodraven and his powers, the more evil he seems. But, you know, we were talking about Jojen and how, you know, he's seen the future and it really haunts him. And he's so solemn and serious that old Nan calls him Little Grandfather. Which sounds kind of endearing, but it's also kind of horrifying. Like, just imagine what it would do to you to know the day you're gonna die. It has aged him. It has made him old before his time to know the horrifying truth of his coming death. And that juxtaposition of the fact that he is a young boy, but he acts like an old, old man, that is a thread that connects to the Children of the Forest. Because the Children of the Forest appear young and youthful, but they live for hundreds of years, and they are connected to the old gods, the souls of the ancient dead who are the old gods and who, you know, provide their memories and their knowledge to green seers. So that whole little grandfather thing itself, you know, it connects to the age of the old gods and the youth of the Children of the Forest and that weird juxtaposition. But we were talking about Roderick Cassell. I want to have a little like Roderick Cassell appreciation corner, because I don't think this guy gets anywhere near enough credit. Roderick Cassell is an absolute bamf and I love him. So let's just do a little recap of what Roderick Cassell has done in this story. So Roderick, he's actually, I don't even know what is he the master at arms at Winterfell, or is he the captain of guard at Winterfell? Whatever. He's a cool dude at Winterfell. He's got some bushy side whiskers. He's an A-grade bloke. And when Catelyn Stark realizes or gets this accusation that supposedly the Lannisters killed Jon Arryn and tried to kill Bran, she says, "We gotta go and warn Ned." So they go down to King's Landing, and Roderick, as the stalwart, stout defender of the Starks, comes along. And protects Catelyn along the way. And he has a horrible time on the ship. He's seasick. He's puking out through his whiskers. I believe he has to shave off his whiskers to get all the puke out of them. So Roderick's suffering, but he's a trooper. And he gets to King's Landing. Then he comes back up north with Catelyn. And at the inn at the crossroads, Roderick is there when Catelyn arrests Tyrion. He is there when they go across the high road, and Roderick fights to defend his lady Catelyn against the clansmen of the Mountain of the Moon. And he's wounded. He's terribly wounded. He's suffering for the Starks. He's bleeding for the Starks. He almost dies on the high road. Bronn says, "Hey, we should leave this Roderick bloke to die because he's done for." But Roderick, he fucking hangs on in there like an absolute fucking champ. And then they get a ship to White Harbor up to the north again, and he's got to go through all that seasickness and puking again. And at Winterfell, he's there for the Harvest Feast, and they're there when they're discussing the Hornwood crisis, because that's what Roderick's doing now. He's dealing with the Hornwood crisis, because what's happened is that Lord Hornwood has died in the war with Robb in the south, and so Danella Hornwood is left as the last surviving Hornwood. There's no heir to Hornwood, so what's going to happen to the Hornwood lands after Danella dies? And Wyman Manderly wants those lands. The Boltons want those lands. The Umbers want those lands. Everyone wants to get on in there. And so the question is, who should Danella marry? So who should get the lands, basically? And there's all these arguments that we see in the previous chapter with Bran at the Harvest Feast. And what happened? And Danella said, "Well, you know, Roderick, maybe we don't have to look far for a potential husband for me." Danella very strongly implies that she has a big old crush on Roderick, and it's adorable because they're both like older people. I think they're both in like their 50s or their 60s or something. Like, they're older folks and they got a big old crush. I ship them so hard, which is ironic because Roderick hates ships. He gets seasick. But I ship Danella Hornwood and Roderick Cassell so much. But tragically, because Roderick is too lowborn or whatever, or he's too old, he tells Bran, "Oh, I'm too old to marry Danella Hornwood, so it doesn't happen." Which is so sad. And Roderick asks Danella for a dance at the Harvest Feast, but she declines, which is also sad. But they like each other. It's a thing. And now what's happening? Roderick is back at Winterfell, but Ramsay Bolton, on the way back from the Harvest Feast, Danella Hornwood was abducted by the bastard of Bolton, and Ramsay has forcibly married Danella and locked her away in a cupboard somewhere, and Roderick has gone off to save her, which they don't talk about it, but like that, Roderick is going off to save his lady love. You know, the gal who he's got a crush on and she's got a crush on him, she's going to rescue her from the villainous Ramsay Bolton. But as we know, what happens later is that I laughed because Michael in the super chat said, "Wyman want the Landerly?" Anyway, and so then Roderick goes to save Danella, but when he gets there, he's too late because Danella, locked away in the cupboard, has eaten her own fingers in starvation and desperation. So Roderick Cassell is forced to find his crush dead in the most horrific way. He failed to save her, which itself is heart-crushing. But then he captures who he thinks... No, he kills who he thinks is Ramsay Bolton, who is actually Reek, Ramsay's disgusting friend. And then he captures who he thinks is Reek, but who is actually Ramsay Bolton, and takes him back to Winterfell. Winterfell? I'm not sure where he takes him. It's a confusing plotline. But then Theon Greyjoy attacks the Stony Shore as a diversion. So Roderick goes off to stop the Iron Man on the Stony Shore. But that was he got jebaited, and then Theon takes over Winterfell, and then Roderick comes back. He has to save the Starks who were taken by Theon at Winterfell, and then he meets Ramsay Bolton at Winterfell because Theon sent Reek out from Winterfell to go and get more men, but he actually got more men to kill Theon. And then Ramsay cuts off Roderick's arm in like a horrific betrayal, and it's awful, and it makes me so sad. And didn't he threaten to hang Beth Cassel? Am I tripping, or did that happen? Let me just Google that real quick. Because didn't Theon threaten to hang Beth Cassel, Roderick's daughter, in front of him? Yeah, Theon used Beth as a hostage. Yeah, that's so horrible. Theon displayed Roderick's daughter Beth with a noose around her neck on the walls of Winterfell while Roderick was trying to take Winterfell back and save the Starks. So horrible. So horrible. And he gets killed. Roderick Cassel, while trying to save the Starks, while trying to save his daughter Beth, while trying to save Daenerys, he gets treacherously butchered by Ramsay Bolton. It's fucking horrible. And does he believe... I think he believes Bran and Rickon dead at that point as well, because Theon claims to kill Bran and Rickon. So Roderick dies believing that he failed. And his house is extinct, I assume? Because, like, Beth Cassel is the last one left, I think. And Beth Cassel is now a prisoner in the Dreadfort in the hands of the Boltons. It's so heartbreaking. There's so many secondary characters in A Song of Ice and Fire who are just absolute straight G's. And like Jory Cassell, who is Roderick's like nephew or something, is also like a straight G. And he also gets butchered in the streets of King's Landing by Jaime Lannister. The Cassells are so great, and they get done so raw, and I'm so sad about it. I hope that Beth Cassel escapes the Dreadfort and does something cool and takes House Cassel into prosperity and happiness, because, oh boy, yeah. So thanks for the super chat from Michael, and thanks for the super chat from Murph, who says, if Valonqar is true, could Cersei be the younger and more beautiful queen? She causes her own downfall by attempting to avert it by self-destruction. Murph, I don't think I've heard that before, and I like it a lot. Because, yeah, Cersei is all about self-destruction. And that's what her prophecy stuff is about, you know? Like, she convinces herself that Tyrion is the Valonqar, and she's wrong, and that is going to contribute to her death at the hands of Jaime, the real Valonqar, probably, when she dies. And she convinces herself that Sansa or Marjorie is the more beautiful, more powerful queen who will cause her downfall. But a lot of people think that maybe Arianne is the more powerful, beautiful queen, or Daenerys is, or maybe Sansa. But no, I like that idea, Murph. Maybe Cersei is the younger, more beautiful queen who will destroy herself. I mean, I don't see how she's younger and more beautiful than herself. Like, how can she be younger than herself? Like, maybe it's, like, about the past young Cersei. Like adult Cersei is cast down by the young Cersei who heard the prophecy about the younger Cersei. I don't know. It starts looping in on itself, eating an Ouroboros pretty quick. I don't know. But that's a good idea. All right, anyway, so we're talking about Roderick Cassel and how he's, like, the greatest and most unappreciated character in A Song of Ice and Fire. And it's this whole sort of Hornwood crisis that's basically just a giant fucking petty distraction from the real important conflicts of, you know, Starks versus Lannisters, and more importantly, living versus dead. It's just all that Game of Thrones shit that's going on, and it's just Wyman being Wyman, you know, just scrumping up some land just like he snorfs up some pies. Wyman just consumes everything. Wyman is like grey goo. You know that whole theory about how if you made tiny self-replicating robots, it'd be a big, big old problemo. Because as soon as you make self-replicating robots, they're just going to replicate all day, son. They're just going to take over the world. The whole world's going to be covered in gray goo. They photosynthesize. They get energy from the sun. They're going to put us into batteries in the Matrix. Bad time. I don't recommend it. Wyman is the same thing. Wyman just consumes and grows. It's all he does. He eats pies. He begats sons. He eats and he knows things. Wyman is terrifying. He'll just take all the North, all the world. His ambition and his hunger is endless. He's a hungry, hungry Wyman. Anyway, what are we talking about? So they start talking about Greensight. And Mira says that, yeah, my brother can see the future with Greensight. It's pretty dank. And Jojen says, you know, it's always true. I know how I'm going to die. By the way, theory, I think that Howland Reed's wife, Gianna Reed, who is the mother of Jojen and Mira, I reckon she's a child of the forest. We don't know anything about Gianna Reed. We don't know barely anything about Greywater Watch, the home of the Reeds. I reckon that the Reeds are just, like, marrying children of the forest constantly. I think it's just one great big interspecies party. I reckon Gianna Reed is a child of the forest. Moving on. But I wonder, like, what Howland Reed's deal is. Like, why does he never leave the Neck? Like, we get all of this hype about Howland Reed is such a cool guy. He knows so much, but what's he doing? Why did he send his kids to Bran instead of going there himself? Like, we're told shortly that Howland Reed sent Jojen and Mira to Winterfell after Jojen told Howland about the dream that he had about the Three-Eyed Crow and Bran and his destiny. Why didn't Howland go himself? Why did he think that his children, who his 15 and, like, 13-year-old children were more capable than he was of, like, guiding Bran magically? Isn't that wildly irresponsible? I wonder if Howland might be crippled or wounded by the fight at the Tower of Joy, because there's all this mystery about what went down at the Tower of Joy. Like, there was a version of it in the TV show, but in the books, we don't know for sure what happened. All we have is Ned's fever dream, and either that doesn't tell us much at all. We don't know how Howland defeated... We don't know how Howland and Neddard defeated Arthur Dayne. And so I wonder if maybe Howland was crippled or wounded or just psychologically scarred and traumatized by what happened at the Tower of Joy. And maybe that's part of why he doesn't leave the Neck. Leon Jin in the live stream chat says maybe he's actually on the island of the Green Men doing more important stuff. I like that. I like that too. Because the island of the Green Men, the Isle of Faces on the God's Eye, is very mysterious and seems to be, like, the center of power of the Children of the Forest and the Old Gods in the South. Maybe Howland's been there. I mean, Howland did go there before the tournament at Harrenhal, right? Or did he just look out to it and pray to it? I don't remember. No, I think he went to the Eye of... I think he went to the Isle of Faces. So yeah, all sorts of possibilities. All sorts of possibilities. And I hope we find out in the Winds of Winter soon. And so Mira and Jojen start asking about Bran's dreams. Because apparently everyone in the castle can hear that Bran wakes up shouting and screaming in the night because he's getting these crazy dreams from the Three-Eyed Crow and the Weirwoods trying to wake his magic powers. Which, again, so, like, Lovecraftian, you know? It'd drive you crazy, waking up in the middle of the night, sweating and screaming all the time. That'd be horrible. It's not cool. Like, this fucking Campbellian call to adventure, it's not fun. Like this is the equivalent of, like, you know, in Harry Potter, when Harry's doing his dance under the envelopes, and all the mail is falling down from the sky, and Daniel Radcliffe is jumping around going, "Oh, hee hee, it's a letter for me. Oh, it's a telegram from Dumbledore. He says I'm going to learn a Patronus." That's not what it's like, homie, in A Song of Ice and Fire. That's not what happens. You dance around in envelopes, you get paper cuts, mate. The call to adventure is horrible. The call to adventure in A Song of Ice and Fire is not a nicely written letter saying, "Come to Hogwarts." The call to adventure in A Song of Ice and Fire is a series of maddening torment from nightmares of falling onto spikes of ice. Like, that's the dream that we saw in Bran 3 of Game of Thrones, and it's awful. And that's what it's like. And so following that call to adventure is the refusal of the call. In The Hero with a Thousand Faces, Joseph Campbell says that, you know, the hero refuses to go on the adventure at first. And that's what Bran rightly does. He says he avoids this talk of his dreams. He doesn't want to talk about his scary, traumatic, falling dreams. And he says, I don't want to talk about the Three-Eyed Crow. And I think that his life would be better if he persisted. I think his life would be better if he refused to go on this adventure, because it might help Westeros, it might help his great destiny, but it doesn't help Bran himself. But ain't that just Bloodraven, you know? Bloodraven will sacrifice any number of children for the sake of the realm, or whatever that means to him. Next page. Jojen's eyes of the color of moss, which I think is one of the most unhelpful fucking descriptions that George Martin's ever done. Moss comes in so many colors. Like Morris Moss, for example, is that his name, Richard Ayoade? Moss can be, green is what they're going for. Jojen's eyes are green, but moss isn't always green. You can get like purplish moss and reddish moss, and you got that rainbow moss and the ultraviolet moss. Tie-dye moss was prevalent in the 60s. Moss with zebra stripes, leopard print moss, 3D moss, 4D moss. Like, I think saying something that is the color of moss is very not non-specific. Anyway, the point is that Jojen is here because he's had dreams from the Three-Eyed Crow. And the dream was, he dreamed of a winged wolf bound to earth with grey stone chains, and the Three-Eyed Crow was trying to peck through the chains to free the wolf. So the winged wolf is Bran. You know, he's a Stark, so he's a wolf, and he's winged in the sense that he can fly, which is a metaphor for having the power of greensight and magic. Which also neatly connects. Euron Greyjoy also has crows with wings on his sigil, and he is speculated to have some kind of magical power and to have been visited by Bloodraven. And you know, Bloodraven himself, his personal sigil was a white dragon, dragons with wings. So you know, wings are, you know, even beyond Bran's story, are a metaphor for power. And I think that works really, really well. Because, like, magic being represented by wings and flight, you know, flight is fun and exhilarating and exciting and addictive, but it's also dangerous. Because we all know the story of Icarus, right? Icarus Picarus, that's what his full name was, little known fact. Icarus of House Picarus. But Icarus, he made his wings from his dad, Daedalus, made out of feathers and wax. And he flew. And Daedalus was like, don't fly too high, son, or else you're gonna get burned by the sun, son. Homophones don't really work in an audio podcast format, do they? Don't fly close to that fiery ball of heat, my male child, is what Daedalus said to Icarus. But Icarus was heedless. He was young, he was bold, he was excited by the flying, and so he flew higher, and the wax melted and his wings disintegrated, and he fell into the Icarian Sea and died, which loops back to our continent discussion from earlier. Europe was named after a cow that Zeus fucked, and the Icarian Sea is named after a Icarus who fell into it. Which is the best way to be to name something, right? Like normally, like a lot of places are named by the person who discovered them, but the Icarian Sea is named after the person who fell into it. I wish that everything that I fell into would be named after me. There'd be wells named after me. There'd be pubs named after me. There'd be bouncy castles named after me. I've fallen into all manner of things, and I think they should all be named after Alt-Shift-X. Like the video, you rubes. Thanks for the super chat from Chocolathoof, who says, have you tried turning your legs off and on again, Bran? Yeah, well, that is what Richard Ayoade would say. That is what Morris Moss would say. Okay, so the dream, the whole reason why Jojen and Miro are here is because Jojen had a dream about a winged wolf bound to the earth with grey stone chains. And the grey stone chains could represent, you know, just Bran's reluctance to go on this journey. It could represent his fear and his doubt, which is what's holding him back at the moment. It could also represent Winterfell, because, you know, Winterfell's made of grey stone. And I wonder how literal that could be. Because, like, we're told, like, Winterfell's a magical place. We know that it was built by Brandon the Builder. And Brandon the Builder also supposedly built the Wall and Storm's End. And both the Wall and Storm's End are said to have magical wards on them that, like, defend them. So I wonder if Winterfell also has magical wards. Seems like a reasonable thing, given how, like, big and important Winterfell is. As, like, a citadel against winter, you know? What with the falling of winter. And so I wonder if the magical wards that protect Winterfell, if they exist, I wonder if those magical wards might protect Bran from the influence of the Three-Eyed Crow. I wonder if these wards on Winterfell are like anti-psychic dampening absorbent energons that prevent psychic attack. Because it's just like Storm's End. Because Melisandre needed to get Davos to sneak her into under Storm's End in order to bypass the magical wards around Storm's End so that Melisandre could get her shadow monster in. So given that Melisandre needed to, like, circumvent the magical wards of Storm's End, maybe that's why Bran needs to circumvent the magical wards around Winterfell by, like, you know, leaving Winterfell. Like, you know, Bran's powers become stronger when he leaves Winterfell and he goes north. I wonder if the greystone chains preventing Bran from fully awakening his magical power might represent the magical wards on Winterfell. There's a hashtag theory for you. Stick that in your subreddit. So the crow is trying to peck through the chains, and that's Bloodraven trying to break the magical wards and to break through Bran's fear and doubt and to break through and to awake the third eye on Bran, because Jojen talks about you have a third eye, which is your magical green sight, and you need to open it to awake your magic. And yeah, again, like, I wonder how much Jojen knows about Bloodraven. Okay, because, you know, Jojen is playing the role of like a herald or a messenger or a intern. He's basically an intern for Bloodraven. He's fetching Bloodraven's coffee, except the coffee is Bran. Because Bloodraven wants Bran for his magical fight against the White Walkers, and so he's using Jojen as a tool to go get that. It's a bit like Cold Hands. Cold Hands is an agent of Bloodraven who's just used as a vessel, and I wonder, how much control does Bloodraven have over Jojen? What kind of nightmares did Bloodraven torment Jojen with? It's framed as like this sort of positive relationship, but like Jojen is a creepy, disturbed young boy. Like, what has been done? Like, what does he know? Like, what strings are being pulled? This is spooky stuff. So yeah, he's being used as like a herald or a messenger. He's like the Silver Surfer to Bloodraven's Galactus, if you will. You know, he's the mouth of Sauron to Bloodraven's Sauron. He's the messenger dude. And I wonder how much, you know, what's going on here. So Jojen explains what Greensight is all about. He says that, like, you know, you can, with your two eyes, you can see an oak tree, but with your third eye, with the power of Greensight, you can see the acorn that the oak grew from, and the stump that it will one day become. So, and you can see, you know, beyond the walls of Winterfell, you can see south to the Summer Sea and north beyond the wall, which Bran has already done. But Jojen emphasizes the time travel element, or the time sight element. You can see the past and you can see the future, and as things develop we realize that, oh, you can not only see the future, you can interact with the future, because, you know, Bran whispers to Ned through the Weirwood trees in his vision at the end of A Dance with Dragons, and Bran whispers to Theon hears a whisper from Bran in the Winterfell Godswood in A Dance with Dragons. Jon, through Ghost, sees Bran as a weirwood speaking to him in this book at Clash of Kings, which I think is a timey-wimey thing. I think that Bran in the future is talking to Jojen in a Clash of Kings. He's talking to Jon in a Clash of Kings. Because at the time when John has that vision, Bran has not awakened his powers much yet. He's still journeying north to the Three-Eyed Crow. And of course, we know that, you know, in the TV show at least, Bran walked into young Hodor slash Willis and broke his mind and turned him into Hodor. So it's not just possible to see the future and past. It is possible to interact with and affect the future and past. Which, you know, again, like, you know, just like Icarus flying to the sun, you know, you have that power, but like, maybe it's a bad idea, mate. Like, maybe don't meddle with the time stream, bro, or those fucking gargoyles from Doctor Who will come after you. The time police. Whoop, whoop. You don't want to piss off the time police. They are a problem. I mean, it's like Pycelle says, like Cersei asks Pycelle, like, is it true that, like, you know, we can tell the future? And Pycelle says, well, you know, maybe a better question is, should we tell the future? And my answer is no. Because, you know, hashtag Grandmaster Conspiracy trying to suppress magic, man. They're out to get us, man. Got to wear a tinfoil hat, man. But it's true. Like Pycelle's right. Like you know, like Val says, or Val's mate says, magic is a sword with no hilt. There is no safe way to grasp it. Magic is dangerous. And that's why Bloodraven is so irresponsible, handing out hiltless swords to 9-year-old boys. It's like handing out syringes at the beach. It's just a bad idea. You can do fun things with syringes. You can also do very bad things. Jesus. So I think that's literally the one time in the series when Pycelle is extremely correct about something. And, you know, so Bran starts getting really uncomfortable about all this talk about magic and dreams because he's, you know, he's traumatized by these dreams and he's traumatized by his fall and he's afraid of all this sort of magical stuff and the power, and it's the refusal of the call. Honestly, just you keep on refusing, Bran, it'd be better for you. But then Bran's like, Bran tries to change the subject. So he's like, oh, let's talk about the neck. Let's talk about your culture. Let's talk about lizard lions. Have you ever hunted a lizard lion, Mira? And so let's have a lizard lion segment, because I got a lot of lizard lion questions. So lizard lions seem to be like crocodiles or alligators, seems to be how they're described. They're like these lizardy monsters who float in water and do some stuff in the swamps in the neck. But there's like 6 or 7 mentions of crocodiles in the Song of Ice and Fire series as like a separate entity to lizard lions, it seems. Like it's not like lizard lions are just the name for crocodiles in A Song of Ice and Fire. No, there are lizard lions and there are crocodiles. I mean, maybe they're just different terms used in different cultures or something. Or maybe lizard lions are alligators, not crocodiles, because alligators are not mentioned in A Song of Ice and Fire. But my headcanon, I believe that lizard lions are a literal hybrid between a lizard and a lion. Just like a mule is the offspring of a donkey and a horse, I think that lizard lions are the offspring of a lizard and a lion, which is not sanitary. Like, that's how you get corona. We got fucking bats rooting pangolins. Get a pangolin bat. Pangolin with wings. Have you guys ever seen a pangolin run? Yeah, go onto YouTube and look up a pangolin running. Because pangolins have 4 legs, and you would think that they would run on 4 legs, but no. No, it's so much better. They sort of rear back on their stumpy little 2 back legs, and they hold up their little front legs like that, and they go, and they just like run along like a little dude, like a little scaly man. Oh, it's so great. Pangolins are great. Anyway, so Bran's like, I don't want to talk about the dreams. I want to talk about pangolins instead. I want to talk about trauma. I don't want to talk about magic. I'm just a boy. I'm a 9-year-old boy. I mean, the saddest thing here is that like Bran and Judge and Amira were just having fun. They were just hanging out. It was like innocent child fun, and it's great. But all of a sudden, like this magic and this politics and these problems have intruded, and it's kind of this sad moment of like, you know, Bran thought he was having innocent fun, but now it turns out that Jojen and Mira want something. They're not just here to be his friends. They want something from him. There's a magical destiny. There's a purpose. And that's a problem with being a politician, right? Like Bran is a prince. Bran is the Prince of Winterfell. Is it possible for someone with that high social status to be friends with people? because everyone wants something. It's like, how can a billionaire be friends with someone? Because everyone you know knows you're a billionaire. They're going to want to get stuff out of you. You know, how do you have friends if you're Jeff Bezos or Mr. Beast? People, or Kim Kardashian, everyone wants something. That's why celebrities only date other celebrities, right? Like, because someone who has, like, an equivalent level of social status as you is the only person who won't use you for additional status. I mean, ideally, hopefully. Yeah, so it's tough at the top, you know? It's lonely at the top. Bran is the Stark in Winterfell, he's the prince, but, you know, that just means people want something from you. And so Bran starts getting angry. Bran starts getting angry. He starts remembering the Golden Man, the Queen's brother in the Falling. Because Bran sort of subconsciously knows that Jaime Lannister pushed him from the tower. But he's really horrified by that memory. And like the Three-Eyed Crow has tried to sort of delete that memory from him. And he's horrified. And he's scared. And he's a 9-year-old boy. He got crippled. And it's so fucked up. And so when Jojen persists and keeps asking, tell me about these dreams, tell me about these dreams. Bran's anger manifests in Summer. And Summer starts getting aggressive and growling at Jojen and Meera. And Bran's like, oh, well, I'm not angry. It's just Summer that's angry. And then Jojen says, no, it's your anger in Summer. It's your fear. Part of you is Summer and part of Summer is you. So, like, Bran has not got control of his skin-changing powers yet, but that's how they're sort of bonded and connected, is Bran's emotions manifest in Summer. And so Summer starts, like wanting to attack Meera and Jojen. He starts getting real aggressive. And Bran and Jojen and Meera have to climb a tree to get away from Summer, who's trying to bite them. So it's dangerous and it's scary. And you know, Meera's like, Jojen, climb up the tree. And Jojen's like, I don't need to climb up the tree. Today is not the day I die. But then Meera's like, stop being such a fucking prophecy fuckwit and climb up the tree to safety, or you're going to get eaten by a dog. And Jojen climbs up. Which is funny, because it's like, you know, what's the... You know, Jojen is totally confident that he can't die, but he still climbs up the tree. What does that mean? You know, like prophecy has to be possible to be averted. If Jojen believes that he's going to die in a certain way, he could jump off a cliff tomorrow and then I'm pretty sure he wouldn't survive. You know, like prophecy can't be bulletproof. Predictions can't be bulletproof. And yet he climbs up the tree. Prophecy is a slippery fish. And then, like, Bran is scared that his friends are getting attacked by the wolf, so he calls Hodor to chase off the wolf. So it was just sort of like a rock, paper, scissors situation. Like, you know, the wolf can beat Jojen, but Hodor beats the wolf. I mean, Hodor beats everything, really. I guarantee there's going to be a crazy moment where, like, Bran walks into Hodor and just becomes ultimate battle master. And it'll probably be really traumatic, but it'll be really cool as well. And so Bran's like, all right, well, this has been like good talk, good chat, Meera and Jojen. I'm glad no one got eaten, but I'm done with your magic stuff. I'm going to like sweep out these magical cobwebs. I'm going to talk to a man of science. I'm going to sort this out with some rational maester knowledge. I'm going to talk to Luwin, my old buddy Luwin. Luwin is like Google to Bran. Like Luwin is like Bran's Ask Jeeves, because Bran comes up to Luwin, the maester, and he's like, hey, what's all this about Greensight? What's all this about Green Seers, Children of the Forest? Like, what's going on there? And it's mentioned that, you know, since Catelyn and Ned and Rob and Roderick have all left Winterfell, the governance of the castle has fallen on Luwin's shoulders, which is like, is he qualified for that? Is Luwin qualified to manage the politics and the military and the day-to-day goings-on of Winterfell? It's like at school when, like, your maths teacher subs in for PE or whatever. Like, that happens all the time. People are just put into roles that they are not qualified for, and then people still get pissy when they don't like the result. Get someone qualified. Anyway, thanks for the super chat from Toto, who says, hi, AltShiftX, big fan of the channel, way better than that doofus AltShiftX. AltShiftX... Man, he doesn't know a gooseberry from a elbow, if you ask me. And so Bran says, hey, Luwin, what's Greensight? What's seeing the future? What's it all about? Is it true? And Luwin says that, well, yeah, you know, there were there were children of the forest, and they claimed to have the power of green sight. And Bran's like, is it magic? And Lewin says, well, you could call it magic, but at heart it was just a different sort of knowledge, which is an interesting comment. And in a way, I think it's sort of true. Because I think that the old gods, it's sort of implied, like we can sort of deduce, I think, that what the old gods are is basically all the souls of people in Westeros, specifically people who believe in the old gods, I suppose, specifically Greenseers, I suppose. When they die, they get sucked into the Weirwood network and they become part of it. The dead are the old gods. The Greenseers are the old gods, we're told in Book 5. And I think that knowledge becomes part of this, like, stored hive database in the old gods. And that's what Bran and Greenseers can access in order to see the past, right? Like, how do you see the tree as an acorn? How do you see Ned in the past? Through the combined knowledge and sight and vision of all the Greenseers of the past and of the future, I suppose. It's like this great mind that is so vast that it bends time and space around its mass. So it's all about cultivating mass in the brain. Cultivating brain mass. That's what I do. I'm doing like 50 reps of book reading to hone my mind sword like Tyrion Lannister. That's what it's all about. So yeah, magic, it's a different sort of knowledge. But Lewin is basically skeptical. He says that, yeah, like, you know, the Children of the Forest, they knew stuff. It was connected to the Weirwoods somehow. And the Greenseers also said that they could control animals, apparently. But, you know, that's not really true anymore. There are no more Greenseers, is basically what Lewin says. He says that, like, yeah, like, you know, like Bran says, oh, but me and Rickon, we dreamed about Ned's death before we found out about Ned's death. That seems kind of magical. And then Lewin says, well, yeah, like, sometimes our dreams do come true, yes, but think of all the tens of thousands of dreams that you've dreamed that did not come true, which is, like, a great, like, skeptical lesson, by the way. Like, that's confirmation bias. The idea that every time something comes true and proves what you want to believe, you remember it. And every time something happens that does not support your beliefs, you forget it. So it's like, you know, like think of a political group that you don't like. Every time someone from that political group does something dumb, I bet you remember it and you talk about it and you think, yeah, people from that group are dumb and I don't like them. But every time you hear about something not dumb or cool or interesting that someone from the political group that you don't like does, you don't remember it because it doesn't fit into your, like, cognitive framework. Our brains are wired to seek out confirmation of the things that reinforce our identity and our feelings and our beliefs about our place in the world. And so we pick up facts that reinforce that. We cherry pick the stuff that supports it, and we forget or explain away or rationalize or dismiss the stuff that doesn't support what we want to believe. There's studies, there's like evidence about this stuff. Like, we have all these biases and this confirmation bias is one of them. And so, you know, Lewin has a really good lesson here, which again, like, you know, I've said it before, like, you know, I always sympathize with the skeptic. I always sympathize with the person who's interested in evidence in fiction. But in fantasy books, the person who is skeptical of magic is always wrong. And there's no exception here because The Clash of Kings is about the rise of magic and its defeat of the mundane, natural world. Magic wins, science loses. And he talks about his maester's chain and all the different metals that represent all the different areas of study that a maester studies. And it's mentioned that Lewin has quite a thick neck, and so the chain is tight around his neck. In the TV show, the chain is quite loose. It just, like, hangs down over their chest. But it's almost like a choker in the books. It's very tight around his neck. It's kind of kinky, honestly, the tight chain at all times around the neck. But the point is that, like, you know, Lewin talks about his childhood and how, like, when he was a boy, he also secretly wished to find hidden powers. And when he was at the Citadel, he tried to, you know, wake the fire from the glass candle, like in that ritual that we hear about in Book 4 of Feast for Crows. But it doesn't work. And so Lewin's like, well, I tried to explore magic, but then I grew up and I don't think magic is real. And it's really funny that he talks about, like, you know, what boy does not secretly wish to find hidden powers in himself? That's such a great, like, meta-genre awareness, such a great deconstruction of fantasy, because every fucking fantasy protagonist, every fucking Harry Potter says, like, ooh, I've got a special destiny, Lily Potter died for me, and now I'm good at the Patronus, I can Accio Nimbus 5000, I'm Harry Potter. Everyone, but Harry, it's not just you, you dingus. Everyone thinks they're special. Everyone thinks they have special powers. So why does only hero protagonist get to be the only person who gets the special powers? Why is it only Neo? You know? Why is it only Obi-Wan, Luke Skywalker? You know? Like, why are you the center of the universe, you adolescent bung face? Because the truth is that everyone is the hero in their own story. And so this fantasy journey that Bran is going on, it acknowledges that, you know, ridiculousness of only one special person gets to be the center of the universe. And I think the ways that it sort of justifies that is that there are other people. There are other people who thought they were the protagonist, like Euron. Euron thinks he's the hero. Euron dreamed of finding hidden powers within himself, and he did, and it didn't turn out too well. And Jojen also was the young boy who thought he had powers within himself. But he found out that, oh, I'm not the hero. I'm actually a secondary character. He resigns. And he knows. That's the thing. He's seen the future. He knows that he dies. He knows that he's not the hero. He knows that Bran is the hero. Jojen has seen it in his magic. And he has to accept that. And that's why he's so haunted. And that's why he's so old. And that's why he's so fucked up. And that's the horror of being a secondary character in another person's story, you know? So I love that almost explicit meta-genre awareness in A Song of Ice and Fire. The horror of being in someone else's story. That's why Jojen is little grandfather. And you know, Lewin waxes lyrical about how, you know, there was magic in the past, but now there's not. He says that mountains rise and fall, rivers change in their courses, stars fall from the sky, and great cities sink beneath the sea. Even gods die, we think. Everything changes. Perhaps magic was once a mighty force in the world, but no longer. The giants are dead, the children of the forest forgotten, the dragons are no more. There is no more magic. It's a really lovely speech. There's a lot of very evocative stuff in here. I mean, the stars falling from the sky. I mean, that sounds like the fallen star of House Dane. We're told that the sword Dawn was forged from a star that fell from the sky. Stars fall from the sky. And, like, you know, the second moon in the sky that we hear about in Daenerys' arc, the second moon that got too close to the sun and cracked like an egg and the dragons flew out. And the black stone of the Bloodstone Emperor and the red comet that might have caused the long night. All sorts of falling star imagery. And cities sinking beneath the sea. That's very Lovecraftian. What if those cities rise again? What if that's what a Shai is? Come to think of it. I don't think I've thought that before. But what if a Shai was a city of the Deep Ones, built by the Deep Ones underwater, but then it rose up? And that's why it's all, like, black and greasy and oily. You know, just like the Seastone Chair. I you know, maybe there's something to that. Because there's very heavy Lovecraftian stuff. And even gods die. I wonder if that refers to the drowned god. Like, the drowned god presumably was not drowned at some point. Presumably he was an undrowned god, but then he became... drowned and died, like Cthulhu or something. I don't know. Lots of very cool stuff. And there's also this, you know, he also says, you know, the years pass in their hundreds and their thousands. And what does any man see of life but a few summers, a few winters? We only have this tiny little window onto a vast world, which again is like a fantastic skeptical lesson. Like Lewin is acknowledging we know so little. We cannot claim to know everything about the world because we see so little of it. Which, you know, acknowledging your ignorance and acknowledging the limitations of your knowledge is such an important, like, intellectually honest thing to do, I think. In every situation, acknowledge how much you don't know. For some reason, like, the count of viewers on this live stream just, like, spiked up to 500 and then back down again. I don't know if we're getting, like, stream raided or if that was a glitch, but whatever. So, yeah, lovely speech from Lewin. And so Bran thinks, well, all right, maybe Lewin is right. Maybe no one has magic. Maybe magic's not real. Magic is dead. Jojen doesn't have the green sight. He's wrong about his dreams. It's not real. And so that's what Bran goes and tells Meera. And he says, well, maybe magic isn't real after all. And so Meera does what is also a fantastic scientific skeptical thing to do. Meera says, hey, let's test it. Let's use some science to figure out whether magic is real or not, in a beautiful fit of irony. Because Meera says, all right, you don't believe the magic's real. Okay, we'll prove that it's real. Here's a dream that Jojen had. Jojen had a green dream that that Walder Frey, Little Walder and Big Walder, and you, Bran Stark, were sitting at supper, and Maester Lewin brought you food. And he served Bran some delicious-looking meat, rare and bloody delicious meat. But Bran didn't like that delicious meat. But the meat that he served to Little Walder and Big Walder was old and grey and dead. This was some grody-ass rump steak, bad, overcooked, horrible, gross food. But they liked it a lot. So the dream is that, you know, Bran gets something good and doesn't like it, but the Walder Freys get something bad and they do like it. And that's the magical dream. And so Meera's like, well, all right, that dream's going to come true and that'll prove that magic is real. But then that night, Bran has dinner and it's just some normal pigeon pie and it doesn't seem particularly strange and the Walders don't do anything strange. So Bran's like, okay, test failed. Magic's not real. Lewin is correct. But of course, then in the next chapter, things change a bit because there is a fulfillment of that dream because later on, Lewin brings Bran and the Walders news. He talks about how, hey, Bran, good news. Robb defeated the Lannisters in battle. But Bran doesn't like that news because he wants Robb to come home and he wants to be finished with all the war stuff. And then the Walders get bad news about the death of their relative Stevron Frey? Is it Stevron? Yeah, I think it's Stevron Frey. And the Walders get this bad news about the death of their relative, but they're actually really happy about it because that moves them up the line of succession. So the point is that fulfills the dream. Like the food was a metaphor, like the good and bad food was a metaphor for good and bad news. So that dream does come true. And so it is like, it is evidence. It is scientific evidence that magic is real, which I love as like, as a sort of irony. Like, you know, I mean, if magic is something that's reproducible and testable and provable, it's not really magic, is it? You know, like the only reason why we don't call Wi-Fi magic is because we can understand it and control it. If we could understand and control magic, we wouldn't call it magic. We'd call it technology, you know? But yeah, look, I always enjoy this, like, you know, magic versus science, supernatural versus skepticism. I always love that battle because that's a real battle, you know. There's many, many people in the world. I mean, everyone to some extent, I suppose, exists on some kind of spectrum between only believing what is proved with observable evidence and having faith in things that can't be proven or haven't been proven. Lots of people have all sorts of beliefs. I mean, you know, it's not just about, you know, I mean, alternative medicine and religion and God and astrology and all sorts of ways that people can have beliefs that aren't necessarily grounded in evidence. But also, you know, just like relationships and hopes and dreams and intentions and habits. Like so much of what we do is founded in non-evidence-based practices. So I think all of us indulge in magical thinking to some extent. And there's also ways to like represent that in fiction. Like, you know, I keep thinking of in Lost, and this is not a spoiler, but in Lost, there's this same ideological battle between the character Jack and the character Locke, because Locke represents faith and magic and destiny, and Jack represents science and reason. Reason will prevail. What's that from? Oh, that's true. It's Always Sunny. Reason will prevail. That's what it's great. So yeah, look, I really enjoy this magic versus science stuff. And spoiler, magic wins. Because like just as in the prologue of A Clash of Kings, Cressen dies and Melisandre wins. You know, like the death of a maester at the foot of magic is such an awesome metaphor for the rise of magic in this book that George Martin uses it twice. Because later on in this book, Maester Luwin dies. He gets stabbed by one of Theon's Iron Men, and he bleeds out onto the Heart Tree in the Weirwoods, in the Godswood, which is like the ultimate place of magic. The man of science dies on the altar of magic. It's the symbolism could not be more obvious. It's about the death of reason and the world of men and science and skepticism and the mundane world and the rise of the supernatural and fire and dragons and old powers waking and shadows stirring. And I think it's just such a beautiful image. And it's such a beautiful image that George uses it with both Luwin and Crescent in the same book. George could not be accused of underutilizing his ideas. Many of George's ideas and metaphors and themes and character dynamics and so many things get recycled over and over, not only between his works, but within the same work sometimes. So the point is, you know, Bran's story is a fantasy story. It's a classical fantasy story of a young boy going on an adventure to claim magical power and save the world. But it's a very genre-aware version of that story. There are secondary characters who know that they're secondary characters, like Jojen, and are horrified by it. There are Gandalfs and Dumbledores, like Bloodraven, who are not kind-hearted wizards, but are actually, like, manipulative, Machiavellian monsters, like Bloodraven, the corpse in the tree in the skull cave with cold hands, cannibalism, manipulation, Machiavellianism. It's terrifying, it's horrifying, and that's sort of the reality of power and magic in A Song of Ice and Fire. The power to save the world is dark, and there are multiple opinions about, you know, what saving the world means. And there's the question of, you know, at what cost do we save the world? How many broken boys must be sacrificed into this pyre to burn away the darkness? How many goddamn Edric Storms and Bran Starks and Jojen Reeds have to be mashed and burned and ground into dust to save the world? It's horrifying. And so that's what George is sort of exploring. And it all comes down to that question of whether magic is real. And, like, at the risk of being a bit too hippy-dippy about it, like, I always liked what Alan Moore said about magic. Alan Moore is the comics writer who wrote Watchmen and V for Vendetta and The Killing Joke and all that stuff. And Alan Moore, like, Alan Moore's hilarious. Like Alan Moore worships a snake god called Glycon. And he knows very well that Glycon is fictional, that Glycon was invented by some ancient Roman cult, more or less as a joke or something. But he worships a fictional god anyway, because he says it's not really the point, you know, whether God exists or not. It's not really worth arguing over whether, you know, miracles and deities and lightning gods who root cows exist. But magic, the force of magic is undeniably real, Alan Moore says. Because, yes, magic only exists in our heads. You know, no one can cast fireballs or summon fish and loaves. Magic does not exist out in the world. Magic exists in our heads. But obviously, in our heads, with our thoughts and our feelings and our imaginations and our intentions, that is where the power of magic is, and that's where magic does its work. Because our thoughts and our feelings and our imaginations are who we are, and they are powerful. And the manipulation of thoughts and feelings and imaginations can change the world. A person can cast a spell on you. A person can be enchanting and destructive and inspiring, and you can manipulate people's feelings and thoughts and intentions by saying the right words and by telling the right story and performing the correct ritual and wearing the right costume and building the right temple. Gods and magic undeniably have dramatically changed the world. And so there's no doubt that magic is powerful, even if it's not, you know, real in a physical, literal, external sense. Magical is real in our heads, and that's what makes it real. So, and that applies to George Martin in a cute little way, because George is a fantasist. He is a boy who is obsessed over superheroes and Arthurian Merlinian wizards and magic and no, none of that's real. Dragons aren't real. White Walkers aren't real. But the belief and the power and the enchantment of those stories of magic did propel George out from his little tiny claustrophobic world in Bayonne, New Jersey. And it allowed him to see the vast worlds that he could never imagine, and it propelled him to fame and riches and power that every boy dreams of, as Lewin said. Magic did grant George all his wishes. And if that's not a testament to the power of magic, I don't know what is. So on that note, I'm going to end this live stream. Thank you all so much for participating in Altshrift X's Game of Thrones Debridged. Go and like the video on the live stream. Go and subscribe to the podcast. Go and rate and review on Apple Podcasts. You can listen to this on Spotify. You can listen to this on a tin can connected to another tin can by a piece of string. You can tap it out on Morse code to your cellmate on the other side of the jail who hasn't got Wi-Fi because he lost those privileges after he shivved his neighbor. You can listen to it however you like. And I hope you enjoyed it. And we're going to do another episode of this in the future. So have a good one. Eat veggies and do cardio. And thanks for the super chat from Sebastian Holden. Cheers.